So, I mean, what I'm going to talk about, I mean, the titles kind of indicate that I'm going to talk about the quantum uncertainty relation. But the way I'm going to present it, the stuff is first to motivate the things through the cryptographic scenario, using the cryptographic applications, and then the uncertainty relation will come at the very end. So that's joint work with Ivan Damgaard, Serge Fier, Renato Renner, and Christian Schaffner. So I have I mean, some slides for all. I mean, I'm trying to get the background here. So I'm going to have some very boring slides for people knowing about cryptography, and other boring slides for people knowing about physics. So let's first start with the two-party primitives, and a scenario that we maybe experience very often. So you have Alice and Bob, and Bob is the owner of a bank, or he runs a bank somewhere. And Alice wants to ask him to give her money from her account. So what she, I mean, what one thing that what that the kind of interaction you do when you go to the automatic telling machine is that you ask the telling machine to give you access to your bank account numbers. So Alice would say, I'm Alice, I want $25,000, for instance, from my account number or something. And Bob would say, okay, right, here is it, here is your money, Alice. but Bob is not completely honest in this thing. So what we can do is just say, instead of giving the money to Alice, he will say, sorry, I'm out of order. And then later on, Bob will just substitute himself for Alice and then go to the real bank and say, hello, I'm Alice, and now I want 22, I don't know what this number is, but it's much bigger than the first one he has seen. And here is the account number or the PIN code or something like that. And then here it is. So you see, this kind of attack is really, it has been done in real life. I mean, you have these fake telling machines. Their only goal in life is to record your PIN numbers, and then after that, you collect these PIN numbers, and then you go to a real telling machine. And then each time the fake telling machine interacts with the user, it says, oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of order, unless you only want 25 cents, in which case the telling machine can give it to you without hurting too much. Okay, so we need to make sure that the interaction does not leak extra information than the strict necessary, and that's what you want to do with this telling machine application. You never want to release your PIN code to somebody who is not supposed to know your PIN code, because you can use it later on. the way these things are modeled in cryptography is using ideal functionality. So what is an ideal functionality? Something of that form, where Alice provides some kind, in this case, for the authentication or identification task that I just pictured on the previous slide. That would be Alice gives her ID, for instance, and Bob give his ID. And at the end, the only things that the box tells us is whether the IDs are matching. So these two people are really the two they claim they are. So that's the ideal functionality kind of way of looking at it. What you want to show is that the tasks you're implementing are do not leak more than what the ideal functionality does. So in general, the functionality can take as input Alice and Bob's input string X and Y, upon which a function F, the ideal functionality, compute a function F for you, and the box only gives the output and nothing else. Okay. So one of the most important primitives for implementing this ideal game is called OT. In fact, the version of OT I'm going to give you here is called also 1/2 OT, but I'm going to call it OT for short. So in this model, Alice and Bob Alice just gives two bits, X0 and X1, and that's what we've seen in the previous talk. And then Bob a selection bit, and then at the end, Bob gets the bit XC. Okay. but I'm going to talk about a slightly relaxed version of that, namely the random version of OT, where Alice and Bob, in fact, where Alice, the two bits that Alice input in the previous version are in fact picked randomly during the process. And that's all as powerful than OT, so you don't really care. We don't really care about the fact that Alice doesn't have the full control upon X0 and X1. In fact, she has no control at all. because you can have only one round of communication after, and then you convert that to a real OT. Okay, so that's exactly the same power than OT, but it's easier to implement for, and it's easier to deal with. So that I'm going to talk about random OT in the following slide. So what you want for a random OT, and it's a pretty complicated thing to define security for one out of two OT. It's really not trivial. I'm only giving you here the intuition behind what we mean by privacy of this primitive. For instance, receiver privacy means that Alice does not learn anything new about C than she already had before the execution of the protocol. So that's a very intuitive way of characterizing the security in this case. The other one would be sender privacy. If there is, I mean, we will say that an ROT is secure if there is one string XD with D and 01, I mean, either X0 and X or X1, for which Bob does not learn anything about. Okay, so that's I mean, the intuition behind what we mean by a secure random one out of two OT, because there is one string down there that you don't know. But the point that we would have to be much more precise than that in the slides, the few next slides. Okay, so that's the intuition behind this thing. I mean, the version that we're going to talk about, maybe not directly, but it's easily generalizable for bit strings instead of bits, and that's the construction I'm going to give you will also allow for that. Okay, I mean, the other primitive that everybody knows about, I mean, it's commitment, so let's pass that quickly, okay? So binding mean that when I use the term binding, when Alice is disowned, there exists a bit that cannot be opened with non-vanishing probability of success. And concealing means that no information about the bit you're committed upon can be extracted given what the receiver got during the committing phase, okay? So what is the power of these two primitives? In the classical world, at least. The first thing is that, I mean, it has been shown, I mean, for, I mean, a lot of works on that have shown that, in the early days of, in the 80s, that if you want an ideal functionality that takes any ideal functionality efficient in terms of the size of circuit for implementing it, that computes f of x and y in a secure way, like that, you can implement that perfect box of that ideal functionality using an appropriate number of OTs. But this one has to take care here. I mean a very idealized world where these OTs are composable. I mean, you have all these composition issues. It's not because you have a perfect OT in isolation that when you put them together that you can build this. But let's say that we have a good enough security criterion that allows us to use a bunch of OT in any order so that they remain secure to some extent. Then if it's the case, then you can always build these ideal functionality if you use enough of these OT. So for this reason, we say that OT is universal for two-party cryptography. Bit commitment is weaker than OT, but it's a fundamental primitive because it's used all over the place to do some of this. Some of these things that are done through OT can be done also through BC, and BC is simpler. So sometimes you're much better than to use a bit commitment instead of a bit of transfer. So, in order to build this primitive, you may ask, I mean, what is needed? I mean, can we build these primitive with classical communication or classical plus quantum communication? But, I mean, everybody knows that. This is not possible classically, and we know that it's not possible quantumly as well. I mean, it's sufficient to prove that OT is not possible in order to prove that commitment is not possible. In the quantum case, a direct proof was given by Lowe, for OT, but you can also argue that the impossibility of, forget about that. So these things are all impossible. So the goal is to relax our assumptions or our settings in order to make at least one of them, or I mean ideally the OT possible. So so there are ways out. I mean, traditionally in cryptography we use computational assumption in order to make these things possible. Okay, so you have to assume that the problem is difficult. It cannot be solved efficiently on a computer or in quantum model that would be against quantum computers. And there's also other model like noisy communication. The security is based on the noise introduced by the channel during the transmission. But and the important thing here, in order for that to be cryptographically powerful as a device, this noisy communication channel, that is that the noise is under the control of no party, at least not under the complete control of all the parties. And you have also physical limitations. And the bounded storage model that I'm going to talk about now is one of these ways out. So let's see what can we do classically in a bounded storage model. But first, what is the classical bounded storage model? So in the classical setting, the bounded storage model is phrased that way, usually always that way. You have a common random string in the sky hanging out, but it's too large to be stored. And it's like you could look at the craters on the moon. I think it's the traditional way of picturing these things. At a certain moment in the protocol, a memory bound applies. So that means that you cannot store more than a specific amount of data. At that point, when the memory bounds apply, then the common reference string disappears or something like that. And in that model, it has been shown that you can do these tasks, OT and bit commitment, by OT. So let's see what are the results in that direction in the classical setting. So there are two things that matters here. How much memory the honest users must use in order to run the protocol, and the security will be against what size of memory for the adversaries. And classically, there are constructions where the honest players, they need to store k bits in their memory. And that the resulting OT will be secure against adversaries having memory of size less than k square. Okay, so you have a linear separation between the two. So the adversary must invest more work than the honest player. So that's the gain here. Okay, the lower bound. it's shown that by Jim Buskey and Maurer, that in fact this construction that is here is optimal. You cannot hope for a bigger separation in the classical world. And K here is a security parameter. So if you want the things more secure, then K increases. You see that the separation is quite low. It's difficult to motivate that if the honest players can invest. Can invest into memory of size k, then the adversaries, by putting just a little bit more energy, cannot invest in memory of size k square. At least k must be very, very large in order for that to make sense. So now the bounded quantum storage model is just the analog of that, except that we don't have a string hanging out in the sky. So quantum memory bound applies at a specified moment in the protocol. After that, the adversary must hold everything in quantum memory of size no more than k qubits. Okay, that's the assumption. But before that, the players are unbounded in both time and space. They can do anything. The resulting security is unconditional against adversary with quantum memory up to k qubits sent over the channel. So it's not a string that hangs there, but it's more the security or the memory size that we're dealing with is a function of the number of qubits sent over the channel. So the adversary is allowed classical memory of unbounded size in that model. So you can store as much as you want in terms of classical stuff. But ideally, for practical reasons, and that's where the model is pretty much different than in the classical case, the honest players need no quantum memory at all. So the classical versus quantum picture is this. In classical case, you have this k versus k square. And where in the quantum world, that's what I'm going to show you, is that we can at least implement random OT with zero quantum memory for the NS players, but n over 2 is necessary for the adversary to break this scheme. Okay? Now, this is the boring slide for the people doing quantum stuff. So I'm going to use this encoding. I mean, everything is based on the BabyED4. I'm going to use this little clock here to indicate measurements. Okay, so I'm using this standard notation. So I put the bases inside, and then the qubit gets in, and then the classical outcome gets out. And then, I mean, this is not for you. Okay, so I'll skip this one. So I write this thing in terms of, the outcome of a measurement is indicated that way. And I'll write also that when you have I'm going to generalize this thing. When I put the theta here and a string here, the theta, this will be understood as the tensor product of qubits in the BBD4 qubits. Okay? So let's see how we can, do a very simple protocol for random OT. So you have Alice and Bob, and then Bob has an input C in 0-1, so that indicates which one of the two strings he wants to receive, and of course Alice has no input because it's the random version. So the first thing she will do, she will pick an n-bit string Z and a sequence of n BabyED4 bases. And then Bob will set his measurement apparatus, and Alice will send the qubits in that state to Bob. Okay, so these are all BBD4 states. And then we'll say that, the memory bounds applies after the transmission. So before the transmission, what Bob is going to do when he receives the qubit, he will measure them all in the same bases, the bases indexed by the selection bits he has. Okay, and that's going to give him some outcomes. At this point, the memory bound applies. So before that, we allow Bob to do anything he wants. I mean, he can do quantum computation, arbitrarily complicated quantum computation. He can measure and store classical data as much as he wants. but once the memory bound applies, we guarantee that the quantum state he holds is no larger than the memory bound. And then Alice will use, the second phase of the protocol will use, the classical communication channel, where she will announce two functions, F0 and F1, taken randomly from a class of hashing function that I'm going to define later. She will compute X0, so the first string that that is sent through the OT by applying the function F0 on all the bits that were polarizing in the plus bases, and she will define the string X1 as the hashing function applies on all the bits polarizing the diagonal bases. Okay, she will announce these two functions together with the bases, and then Bob, on the other side, if he measured everything in the plus bases, then he can reconstruct the Z plus here. Because he measured all these positions correctly without errors, and if he had measured everything with C is equal to 1, in the diagonal bases, he would be able to reconstruct Z times, and then to compute F0 or F1, depending in what in which case he is, and that will allow him to recover either X0, XC, in fact. Okay, is it clear? So that's the protocol. It's pretty simple. And the funny thing is that it's one-way communication. It's pretty. It's not usual that an OT it requires only communication in one direction. It's kind of weird. But what is the intuition behind what? How could you handle the proof of security in this case? So let's look at the bit strings that was selected by Alice and put the yellow bits are in the time bases, the other in the plus bases. So when Bob, this is really the intuition behind the security. So when C is equal to 0, Bob will measure everything in the bases that will be time in this case. No, that will be plus. So he will, when the bit is red, it will get the same bit, but when the bit was yellow on Alice's side, then it will get something random, and the same thing when C is equal to 1, it will get the yellow one. So once the bases and the functions are announced, Bob knows that there are some positions that are random and uncorrelated with Bob. In fact, because these bases are incompatible. So that means that you will see something like that, and the rest is just pure noise. And once you have that, I mean, the same thing when c is equal to 1, once you have that, you just apply the function. So it seems that, that's the first thing. You see, if you select a basis that allows you for getting the bit correctly on one slot, it looks like you randomize the whole thing in the other bases. So at least there are two things that we can already establish about this protocol is the correctness. It's correct here, statistically correct, because it could fail. For instance, Alice is unlucky, she picks only a plus. But I can also patch it so that it works even in that case. But so let's say that it's correct, more or less. Okay. And it's receiver private, because there is no way Alice can get any information about the selection bit. There is no message coming back from Bob to Alice. Okay. So the real problem here is to prove sender privacy, and that's where the memory bound applies. Okay. So how are we going to do that? But we need to define precisely what it means for Bob to get no more information about one string XD for some D is equal to 0, 1, and that this has to be formalized the right way. We need to model Bob's strategy with the bounded quantum storage model. What exactly is he allowed to do? We'll also need to look at how private simplification works using the first theorem about private simplification where the memory was of a fixed size. Anyway, that's Enigma and Anna. And at the end, we'll see that in order to make this working, we'll need an uncertainty relation. We'll need to characterize the amount of uncertainty you have about some measurement of a state. Okay, and that's where the uncertainty relation will come in. Okay, before I just want to really just very quickly talk about variational distance. Okay, so I'm going to, the variational distance between two classical probability distribution. I mean everybody knows about that, I guess. It's just this equation there. We'll use this notation that when Q is uniform, we'll leave it out in the notation. So the small d of p means the distance at what distance p is from the uniform distribution. And more generally, if PXV is a joint probability distribution of random variable X and V, we'll write DXV as this equation, where in fact we look at how much the joint distribution is away from a distribution that is like a product distribution. And the nice thing, and this observation was made by Renato at some point, which makes the thing very 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 nice for compositions and things like that. It's like you can interpret this variational distance like if dxv, if you look at dxv, that means that x behaves like a random and uniformly distributed random variable given v, except with probability at most dxv. And that's what makes this distance measure so useful in cryptographic scenario. Yeah. Did I make a mistake?
No, should it be?
The what? No, I don't think so. No. No, I don't think so. These things should ask you, Renato. Okay. So how do we define sender privacy? So I'll start with defining it for the classical case. The quantum case will come along nicely. So we'll say that a protocol for OT is sender private if for any receiver B with Bob with view V, okay, there exists a random variable D in 0, 1, and that's the point here. The D must be a random variable, otherwise there is no way you can get this working. Such that the distance from uniform of the string or the string x1 minus d is negligible. Or thank you. That's embarrassing. Okay. Okay. So we say that if there is a random variable d that shows you a string such that this string is at distance epsilon from uniform, then we say that the protocol is epsilon sender private. Yeah.
So Andres, in the talk, mentioned other definitions of sender privacy, right? That is basically Bob probability of guessing the combined bit x0, x1 is at most half.
That's too weak.
So you say that that's not as.
That's the right definition. No, that's not what I'm saying. I mean, you have millions of security definitions for OT. Some are good in some cases. Some are not good in these cases. Some are better in these. I mean, it's difficult. What you want is a definition that somehow capture the composability issues, and this does.
Okay.
What I told you earlier, but it's not about sender privacy. It would be more about receiver privacy. But the way it's defined, it was defined earlier, it seems that the only weakness you had was the error probability in the transmission. Does not even allow you to build a bit commitment from this OT. It's not even the powerful enough to build a bit commitment. You have to take extreme care when you define these things.
Okay. Right.
Well, sender privacy, it's not. I don't think it's enough to talk only about the guessing probability of the pair of bits. I'm sure it's not. I'm going to give you a characterization. It's not that far from. I mean, in the bit case, that could be the same thing, but not in the string case. So what we're going to see, what this thing is saying is that for any view V Bob can obtain, it's always the case that there exists a random variable d such that x1 minus d is close to uniform. It's just a random variables that is defined in terms of the view of the protocol. I mean, it's just that it's guaranteed to exist, but I cannot define it only by looking at the code. It might be a random process. We just proved the existence of that. Yeah, Bob may not even know it. That's the problem that you have when you want to define it explicitly. Yes.
Can you reformulate it?
Yes. Okay. My God. Oh my God. Okay. So I just have to make a little digression on random state. So what is it that this thing? I mean, the model of the view of the adversaries compared to what Alice sees during the execution. You can look at Bob's state after he compresses the stuff into this memory of size Q, as being some kind of correlated with the output that Alice gets, this Z that she measures. And it's correlated. I mean, it's expressed that way. Okay. So you have a state that contains Alice's states and Bob's states, and it can be represented by this equation where the left hand side belongs to Alice and the right hand side belongs to Bob. so you see that what Bob sees is a mixture of that form, and what we can define, and in fact. We define the distance from uniform in this case by the trace norm distance by this way, like the distance from uniform of random variable z given the view of Bob's view is defined that way. So that's the distance or the trace norm distance from the state containing both random variables and the uniformly distributed states on analysis side tensor product Bob states. Okay, that means that Bob is not correlated to Alice's registers. So rho u here defines the identity over the alphabet size. And then, as before, the interpretation is that Z behaves like a random and uniformly distributed classical random variables, except with probability D stuff. Okay. So sender privacy in a quantum case is just phrased that way. We just copy the classical statement and the classical definition into the quantum case, or translate it, and that's what you get. Okay. So you just replace the variational distance, the trace norm distance, using that. Okay. So there is a problem. It's not easy or straightforward to define this D. Well, one has to. I mean, the definition tells you have to identify a D, and that's what is difficult in this setting. So if you stick to that definition and try into the proof to identify this D and define it precisely, you really run into troubles. It's extremely difficult, at least. I don't know how to do it. So what we've done is that we showed that there is another way to describe something that is equivalent to that, and for which the proof or the identification of the D will be done automatically for you. So you don't really have to identify this D. This D will come out. Okay, and how you do how you do that is by using this the following practical version of the sender security criteria, which is defined in terms of non-degenerate linear function. Okay, so we say that the non-degenerate linear function beta is a function of that form. It takes two inputs, an n-bit string, and map that into a one-bit, and the mapping is linear in a0 and a1 for non-zero and a0 and a1. Okay, so we call this function NDLF. Okay, and then what we've shown is that for any quantum view rho b for Bob and any NDLF beta applied on x0 and x1, the two strings coming out of UT, if it's the case, then the distance from uniform, the output of this NDLF given the view of Bob is smaller than that, then the protocol is epsilon sender private. And that to some extent gets rid of the problem of identifying D. Okay, because the only thing I have to show is that the evaluation of beta on the two's input is unknown to Bob. And if it's unknown, then the proof works by defining this random variable D. Then but it will be guaranteed by using this theorem. Okay. So for random OT of individual bits, so if you only x0 and x1 are bits, sender privacy, I mean the beta, the set of NDLF in this case is only the XOR function. Okay. In other words, what I'm saying is that in the case, and that is your question that you asked, I don't remember who asked the question, but you can say for one out of two bits transmission, I mean it's sender private if the receiver has no information about the XOR. Okay, and that's sufficient. That's an if and only if. For strings that contains more bits, you have to hide all the NDLF. Okay, and there is more NDLF in this case. But in the case of bits, there is only one. It's the XOR and the negation. So private simplification. Private simplification. We use the private simplification theorem based on the smooth min entropy. So you know what the min entropy is. So it's just the log of the highest the probability. The smooth version just has a little epsilon here, and in fact, what you do, I mean, an operational way of defining that is that just you allow to cut probabilities in this probability distribution in order to reduce your mean entropy. So in this case, you would cut the highest peak by a fraction epsilon, and then your mean entropy will reduce. Okay, I need also two other things. I need a class of function or two universal class of functions because private simplification works with those. I mean, I guess that everybody knows about that, but I will need a little a more stringent class of hashing function called strongly universal. These are very similar to two universal, except that they have nice property with respect to the size of the preimage. Okay. So what the privacy simplification theorem tells us is that the information you have about the output of the hashing function on a random variable z, given the hashing function and the quantum state, is lower bounded, is upper bounded by the min entropy, I mean 2 to the power 1/2, and the min entropy minus the memory size minus the size of the output of the function plus 2 epsilon. That's the thing you have to pay because you don't have the min entropy here, but you have the smooth version. Okay. Okay, and that's what we're going to use to show the sender privacy. So before, I'd like to talk about, I mean, to kind of characterize what Bob's attacks are. So in the protocol as I defined it, Bob's attacks are of that form. So he received a bunch of BBD4 qubit. He decided to plug that into a shrinking quantum machine, and that gives him some kind of memory of size q qubit. And by doing that, he gets some classical information on the size that on the side. Whoops. The W did not appear, but anyway. And then you get the classical communication at this point. So given this classical communication, given the size of this quantum memory, we want to find out how much information he has about the NDLF about an NDLF beta applies to both strings. Okay, that's what we have seen just on the side before. That's equivalent. So if Bob cannot get information about that, then that means that the protocol is sender private. Okay, but this is not easy to deal with because we're going to use a standard trick in order to simplify the setting a little bit. We're going to use a short Preskill, or I should say Eckert short Preskill argument. So instead of Alice sending n qubits, you will send n AFPR pairs. Okay, so that is what happened, and then the other half EPR pairs, I mean the half received by Bob will be put in the shrinking machine, and the memory, and then an entanglement, some kind of entanglement will be produced by this process, and Bob will get some classical information on top of that. Okay. And then the idea is how much. So what we are looking at is, and then Alice at this point will measure to fix the Z. And what is important to characterize is where F, I mean, remember that F is too universal. But what is important to characterize is the min entropy or the smooth min entropy of this random variables here. If you have that, you run that through the private simplification machine and things will work fine. We hope so, but we need something before. So, so the question is, how much information about beta applied to x0 and x1, which is beta of f0 z plus f1 z times, is available to Bob, given rho z, that is its quantum state, given the description of the two functions, and given the bases? Okay. We don't need to worry about w, because the only things that this thing that we will have to characterize is the min entropy of that, and it's independent of the classical memory or the classical state that Bob had. So, so if you take these NDLF, hashing function, and then you take the setting after Bob has made his compression, and we look at how these x0 and x1 are defined. Okay, you remember, this is the definition of x0, and this is the definition of x1. And when you apply beta on that, you just apply beta on f0 and f1 applied on these z. Okay, and what is handy here, and what is very 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 nice here is that, and helps to make the thing working, is that you can show that for any NDLF beta and for any strongly universal two class of hashing function, then the composition of beta on F0 and F1 is itself two universal. So that means it's a private simplification class of a function upon which you can run private simplification securely. Okay? So in other words, you can run private simplification and then you get the security. But you just have to make sure that F0 and F1 are strongly universal instead of universal. That's the only thing you have to, the cost of this. Okay. So we need an uncertainty relation that will allow us to say that the variable Z have enough min entropy in order to run private simplification. And this min entropy will give us the size of the memory that we can tolerate on for the adversaries. So we need one technical tool that is a completely classical tool. So suppose you have n random variables over an alphabet Z, and suppose that you're guaranteed that H of the Shannon entropy of Zi plus 1 given the history is larger than H for all I. What can we say about H of about the entropy of all the variables? And that's easy. That's just you multiply them together, n times H. But what about the min entropy? If the Zi's were IID, then that would be, roughly speaking, NH, okay? Using the Chernoff bound. but what about when the Zi's are dependent? And that's the problem, because in our point of view, the analysis is put on the point of view that Bob has the control. I mean, he can put the state, he can really generate the state or create the state he wants between Alice and Bob. And so that means that these Zi's are not necessarily IID. So we need a theorem that tells us what happens in this case, okay? And that's the theorem. That given n dependent random variable over an alphabet Z, for which it is guaranteed that given any history, the entropy is at least H on each position, then the min entropy of the sequence of n random variables is about NH, okay? It's about, I mean, it's like, it's the same thing as if they were IIDs, okay? And in order to prove that, we use a generalized Chernoff bound called the Azuma inequality. So let's get back to OT just quickly to show you exactly what we're going to look at. So you have this stuff, you have the measurement, you have the Zi's, the random variables, thetas are random variables here, so we put them together. And then we define Zi prime being the two random variables together, okay? And we want to find a lower bound on the entropy of Zi's prime given the history, okay? And that we're going to use Mattson and Ufink, okay? Because if you take one Zi, it's one of these, you measure any state psi whatsoever in one of these two bases, we know that the entropy the entropy of Z given the bases is at least 1/2. Okay, that's what Mattson and Ufink told us, and that remains true for all histories. I mean, I could condition whatever I want. So, theta is where theta is against. I mean, this is just repeating what I said. Okay, and then if you plug that Mattson and Ufink which only talks about Z and not the Z prime, and you put the Z prime inside, you get 3/2. Okay. So that means that, in other words, it's just that you split, you use the chain rule, you split the theta with the Zi, and then you get 1 bit on the left-hand side, and Mattson and Ufink gives you 1/2 bit on the other side, that gives you 3/2, okay? And, because we have that, this little h that I had in the previous theorem, I can conclude that the min entropy of the sequence of n Z prime is 3n over 2. What we need is the min entropy of Z and not Z prime. Okay, so we just use the chain rule for min entropy. Okay, that tells you that the min entropy of everything is the sum of these two things. Okay, where the things that I did not talk about here is N. Okay, because this is just the rank of the probability distribution, and then we get the uncertainty relation. The uncertainty relation tells us that for any lambda between 0 and 1/2, we have that the min entropy of the whole thing, conditioned on theta, is about the Shannon entropy. Okay. And then that's done. Because of all that, what I said before, OT protocol is sender private against any receiver with quantum memory of size about NF. I think I have to stop the, I'll skip the conclusion. Do I have? Yeah, I do. Okay, thank you. Yeah, it does. For instance, you can use these OTs to do an identification scheme as I described.
Right, that's
okay, but the problem is that you can show that if Bob is dishonest, he doesn't learn anything. If Alice is dishonest, she doesn't learn anything about Bob's secrets. But if there's somebody in the middle, he can learn something. So that's the man in the middle is another issue.
And this is what you had on your slide.
No. On my side, they were not in the middle. In the middle, I mean really an eavesdropper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Lenny.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a coffee break now, and we reconvene at 11:30.
Je pense que c'est pas la même question. Donc toi tu dis que le problème c'est que Eve qui est entre les deux
pourrait
apprendre un des bits d'Alice.
Quelque chose du genre. Elle peut changer la communication entre les deux. Puis elle utilise le fait qu'Alice et Bob sont honnêtes pour apprendre des choses.
Oui,
que ni un ni l'autre apprendrait si l'autre était malhonnête, parce que ce serait un contre l'autre et non, tu n'utilises pas deux personnes honnêtes contre.
Okay.
C'est, le setting est un peu différent.
Oui, fait que la question, c'est. Parce que. Non, c'est pas ce que tu avais sur tes acetates au début, c'était pas si loin d'un man in the middle attack. C'est-à-dire,
ouais.
Tu te présentes à la banque. Moi, je prétends être la banque, puis chaque fois que tu me parles. Je passe le message à la vraie banque.
OK. Si tu le faisais comme ça, ça marcherait. Je ne suis pas sûr que ça marcherait. Ben, faut voir quelle sorte de protocole je ne sais pas.
En principe, il n'y a rien qui empêcherait avec les trucs quantiques de même d'avoir la non-malléabilité.
Oui. Mais c'est là-dessus qu'on est en train d'essayer de régler le problème, puis on a des problèmes avec ça. Moi, je pense que c'est impossible.
Non, c'est bien mieux de même. Cette analyse-là est bien. Plus élégante déjà que la première.
Oui, je pense. C'est plus difficile à suivre. Et plus aride. Parce que c'est une...
Okay. Moi, je l'aime. C'est-à-dire, j'ai lu l'autre papier en détail.
Ouais. Moi, j'aime mieux celle-là.
Ouais,
c'est plus forte. On arrive à la même borne et on envoie deux messages.
Et je me rappelle, dans l'autre, il y avait comme un gros trou.
Mais il n'y en a pas parce qu'il est optimal aussi. Mais c'est parce qu'on utilise un autre codage.
Ouais, non, mais il y avait quelque chose qui me mettait pas satisfaisant dans l'autre papier. Je me rappelle plus exactement, mais je me disais que manquait. Comme ça, il me semble que c'est plus.
Oui.
Tight.
C'est plus tight, c'est tight. Et tu peux pas faire mieux. Mais c'est plus. Comment dire?
Non, mais c'est plus comme. Machine algébrique, un peu.
Maybe you can push the complexity into the context of conditional quantum conditional entropy and stuff. So sometimes the magic is in the notation.
Yeah. You can also use it what you do here, funnily enough.
And
yeah, it's
not think that there must be, like,
that's
like
what
for all
the
rule B.